There was no collusion at all. No collusion.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many. They always say the lawyer, and then they like to add the fixer. Well, I don't know if he's a fixer.
So Rudy knows it's a witch hunt. He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight.
I understood Michael Cohen very well. Turned out he wasn't a very good lawyer, frankly.
Says who?
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, a special series from Left, Right, and Center. This show is all about President Trump's legal issues, which are complicated. They bring up really good questions about free speech and defamation and Twitter and whether you can assert testimonial privileges related to being a top advisor to the president, even if you have never worked in the White House. It was clear we need to devote some time every week to answering some of these big legal questions. So I called Ken White. Ken is a criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles and was formerly a federal prosecutor. Ken blogs about the law at popehat.com. He hosts the First Amendment podcast, Make No Law, and he's my co-host and legal navigator on this show. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
In the interest of full disclosure, unavoidable scheduling conflicts have required us to tape this week's episode on Tuesday instead of the normal Wednesday morning taping we do. So we're taping right as former Trump campaign manager Corey Lewandowski is before the House Judiciary Committee answering questions, or really trying not to provide meaningful answers to questions. This is the House Judiciary hearing where members wanted to hear from Lewandowski and former Deputy Chief of Staff Rick Dearborn and former Staff Secretary Rob Porter. They wanted to ask about possible incidents of obstruction of justice that are described in the Mueller report, but Mueller and Dearborn are not appearing, citing privileges related to their former roles as top White House advisors to the president. Lewandowski has never worked in the White House, so he is appearing, but the White House has instructed him not to answer questions about his dealings with the president or senior White House staff after Trump took office. So, Kent, first of all, Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler says this hearing is an impeachment hearing. Is it an impeachment hearing?
Well, it is if he wants it to be. You don't have to do anything magical to make it start being an impeachment hearing. And if he proclaims it as one, then you can treat it as one. But that statement might be intended to shore up the Democrats' chances to compel testimony and compel documents in litigation that's currently going on.
Okay, we'll talk about all of that in a little bit. So let's talk about why the witnesses that they're seeking either didn't show up or aren't being as useful as they hoped for. The White House claimed that there is an absolute immunity for top White House advisors to testify about their interactions with the president. What's the deal with that claim? My understanding is that Trump didn't come up with this idea, that this is a claim that we have heard from the Bush White House and from the Obama White House previously.
Right. And it was always made up. There's no basis for it. It's just a pure assertion that really important people in the White House have some sort of privilege not to have to testify. The legal basis is purely speculative. It's, you know, asserted that just based automatically, naturally, based on the structure of the government, without any real precedent, no cases establishing it, no laws saying that it's there. And we have heard it multiple times. And so far, it's always been negotiated away, or one side or the other has backed off, so that it's never gone to court for a definitive ruling on whether or not it exists, which it does not.
So is it possible that we're going to end up in court over that this time? I mean, it seems like this Congress and this administration are in less of a good position than previous ones to come to an accommodation. My understanding when we've talked about this previously is that you think both sides are sort of afraid of what the courts are going to do if they get there and seek a ruling on this. So is that are they going to find a way to avoid getting that ruled on again this time?
Right. Well, it's like any other tool in government. Everyone is thinking a little bit about whether they might like to use it when they're in power, when they're in the White House. So they are thinking, they're not entirely sure that they want to get a definitive ruling that there's no such privilege in case they want to use it in the future. And they're also, if it's the congressional Democrats, they may not be entirely sure that the court will rule their way. You pick the wrong judge and who knows what you get. Although I do think that it's a very weak claim that the privilege exists and that any judge who found it would be making up out of whole cloth.
So my understanding of the argument for the existence of this privilege for top advisors is that it has to do with what I think is not a very controversial idea, that the president himself has a privilege against being hauled to testify before Congress. So is that claim of privilege itself controversial, or is that privilege is real, but it clearly applies, in your view, only to the president himself?
To the extent it exists, that only applies to the president. And we already have another privilege that helps the president in his interaction with his advisors. And that's the other one that's at issue this week, the executive privilege, which covers communications between the president and his top advisors and employees in the White House. So theoretically, that ought to do what you're trying to do by immunizing these people from talking entirely.
Well, but except that that privilege is not absolute, right? They might still have to appear, and there would only be certain questions they could decline to answer because they would implicate executive privilege.
Exactly. And that's why they're calling this other one an immunity, basically that you can't even haul them into Congress to testify. They don't have to answer any questions. Executive privilege, you have to show up and you have to invoke the privilege on the record. And then they can, you know, try to force you to say why you think there's a privilege, and they can challenge it in court.
So then what do we make of this claim regarding Lewandowski, where he's shown up, but the White House has instructed him not to answer questions about his dealing with the president or senior advisors to the president, and claiming that there is some sort of privilege that extends to him such that he should not answer those questions, even though he has never worked in the White House?
Well, one of the members of the committee referred to it as a crony privilege because, you know, executive privilege is understood to apply to appointees and employees and people in the White House who work there. And here it's being used to apply to someone who never worked at the White House, was never had an official role in the government, who did have a role on the Trump transition team between election and inauguration. And that's the hook they're hanging it on, the idea that he must have had communications with the president that might go to the deliberative processes that eventually led to policy once Trump took office. But that would be a dramatic expansion of the executive privilege because the president's talked to all sorts of people who aren't formally part of the administration. Many of them throughout history have had advisors in academia or business or politics who talk to them. And if they can start calling all those people as falling under the executive privilege, that dramatically increases the zone of secrecy.
And so the remedies available to the committee, basically, do they have any remedy available other than going and seeking those court rulings about the extent to which these privileges and immunities exist? And so if the committee is not willing to do that, then basically they'll have to take whatever testimony they can get from these people?
They could order him to answer, claiming that it's not a good privilege, and ask for him to be prosecuted for contempt of Congress. That's not going to happen. They could have, theoretically, the sergeant-at-arms arrest him. I don't think that's going to happen.
That would be kind of fun.
But so it would be. I mean, you got to think that guy's job is pretty dull most of the time. Or they could go back to court get in line with the other dozen cases about the conflict between Congress and this administration and what Congress is entitled to get.
Speaking of those dozen or so other cases, the committee is still fighting with the executive branch over underlying materials that helped put together the Mueller report. Among the materials the committee would like to see are grand jury materials from the Mueller grand jury, and the Justice Department says it legally cannot produce those materials to Congress, even though Congress would very much like to see them. So there's been a lot of outrage on Twitter from Democrats about the Justice Department trying to conceal these materials from the grand jury. My recollection is that you think the Justice Department actually has the better of this legal argument about whether these materials should be produced?
I think they certainly have a strong argument. As we talked about before, Josh, a grand jury material is secret and it is governed by a specific written rule, not by just a judge's discretion. So for a judge to allow grand jury material to be released, it has to meet one of the specific exceptions in the rule. And we recently had a court say basically you can't just do it because it's historic and important. You can't make up a new exception and graft it onto the statute. Here, the legal dispute is a slightly wonky one. The question is, what is a judicial proceeding? So the Democrats are arguing that what's going on in Congress is a judicial proceeding, that maybe if the Senate were trying the impeachment case, that would be a judicial proceeding, or maybe if when Congress is deciding whether to impeach. That's a judicial proceeding. And the government, the White House is saying, no, it's not. I mean, it's you don't have a judge. Judicial proceeding, the way it's defined everywhere else is something that happens in court with the judge. This is something different. If they wanted to mean that it can go to Congress, they could have said that in the rule. Complicating this is that there are a series of cases about this from the Nixon era that allowed some grand jury material to go to Congress during impeachment, but didn't really explain why. So it's a somewhat tough call. But this is not a frivolous or ridiculous argument by the administration. It's actually a very defensible one.
If there were an impeachment trial of the president, it would be presided over by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. There would be a judge.
And that would be, I think, probably the absolute best argument for it being a judicial proceeding. And what the White House is doing is saying none of it is judicial. And even if something is judicial, it certainly is one of these hearings where the Democrats can't even commit to conclusively saying we are starting impeachment proceedings.
Right. And so that takes us back to where we started. One key question is, you know, even if impeachment could be a judicial proceeding that would get to one of those exceptions where you are allowed to release grand jury material, is this impeachment that's going on, and is it good enough that Jerry Nadler is out there saying that this is an impeachment hearing? Does that make it so? And in fact, one of the things that the Department of Justice points to in its brief arguing that the material should not be released, they have statements from other members of Democratic leadership saying that what's going on is not an impeachment proceeding. But then I guess the question is, does it matter what people are calling it? Because that would normally not be a good way to construct a rule like this. You don't want people to just be able to say, well, this is X, and therefore I should get into the exception. You would want it to be more substantive than that, presumably.
Right. And generally, the law in this sort of situation looks more at substance than at labels. I think the judge in this is going to have to look at these Nixon-era precedents and decide whether or not anything in Congress can be treated as a judicial proceeding, and then really say, well, what really makes one? What starts one? And I don't think the judge is going to accept the proposition that just any hearing that could lead to more hearings that could lead to an impeachment proceeding is going to qualify.
The emoluments cases are back, or one of them anyway. These are the three cases about the Foreign Emoluments Clause, whether the president is violating the Constitution by receiving payments from foreign governments or entities without approval from Congress to receive those payments. This is not to be confused with the Domestic Emoluments Clause issue we discussed last week that has to do with whether there's anything improper, constitutionally improper, about Air Force personnel staying at the president's resort in Scotland at government expense. That is a separate issue. So in this case about the Foreign Emoluments Clause, a federal trial judge in New York had thrown out one of these suits. This was the suit that was brought by the liberal pressure group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. The suit is on behalf of hotels that compete with Trump's hotels. So anyway, this suit had been thrown out a while back. Now a three-judge panel of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals has brought the case back from the dead. What is their reasoning for doing so?
Well, they thought that the trial court construed standing too narrowly. This is, again, a standing issue, which has been the bane of all of these emolument cases. In the lower court, the court basically said it's speculative as to whether or not these hotels are suffering any sort of harm because people might want to go to the president's hotels to curry favor with the president and the administration.
And that is, I mean, we don't know whether we don't know necessarily whether that's happening. And even if we do, we don't know whether they would have otherwise stayed in the hotels of these people who are suing.
Exactly. So like, you know, if the government of France, if they're staying in Trump Tower, is it because they want to curry favor with Trump? Do they just like the room service? Do they have terrible taste? It could be any one of a dozen reasons that they're there. That was the point of the lower court judge. The Court of Appeal took a more traditionally lenient view of what someone has to prove at the beginning of a case as opposed to later on in the case, and said that they've alleged enough facts to raise the inference that there is a connection there and that they are suffering harm as a result of this idea that people are going to Trump properties in order to get anticipated good treatment by the Trump administration. They also took a different tack in terms of what the remedy is, because one element of standing is whether or not a court can do anything about the harm you're talking about. And they didn't really get into the deepest and most troubling questions, which is whether you can order the president to, you know, put his portfolio in a blind trust or something. But they did get into ideas that they could use rules that stop, you know, Congress could pass laws, or there could be orders that could, to some extent, stop people from going exclusively to the Trump properties, or stop the Trump properties from offering special deals to get those people.
So other appellate courts, I believe this is the third time an emoluments case has gone to an appeals court, because you have the two other cases. They've both gone up to the appellate level already, and those appellate circuits have been a lot more negative on these cases when they have touched them. So is this a circuit split now? Is this something where the Supreme Court's going to have to rule, or is it that the issues that have been presented in the various different courts have been different enough and preliminary enough that this will kick around the trial and appellate levels for a good while before it possibly gets to the Supreme Court?
Well, there is a split now between what the Second Circuit, which is generally more on the liberal side, and the Fourth Circuit, which is generally more on the conservative side, have said. But I don't think the Fourth Circuit case is ripe for review by the Supreme Court yet, because they've sent the matter back down to the trial court for some further proceedings. The Second Circuit case, though, could be ripe after this, and the Supreme Court might decide to accept it. I would not be surprised at all if there is a petition for cert after this decision, and we will then see whether we get this much vaunted effect that people have been talking about since the beginning, where we can expect the Supreme Court, newly constituted with Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, to vote to do things that will slow down these types of lawsuits against the president.
Before we take a break, we want to recognize and thank some more fans of All the President's Lawyers who became KCRW members in the last week. We love seeing your messages and support for the show. Jacob Rosenberg from the Bay Area says, All the President's Lawyers is the best thing to come out of Southern California since, well, ever. Keep up the great work, guys. Spoken like a true San Franciscan, I hope you enjoy taking a light jacket everywhere you go, Jacob. Caitlin Stamm in Garden City, New York says, My week wouldn't be complete without ATPL and LRC. They make me feel smart when there's so much stupidity in the news. Thanks, KCRW. Thank you, Caitlin, and thank you for supporting KCRW. Megan Mitchell in Las Vegas says, I've never lived in L.A., but Ken White is my hero. I do pray for the day when it just might be Rico. Ken, is it Rico today?
It is not yet Rico, Josh.
Sorry, Megan, it's not Rico. Judy Ann Barrow from Connecticut says, Love Left, Right, and Center and All the President's Lawyers. Keep it coming. Thanks, Mom. We appreciate that. Joshua Gottlieb threw down a challenge. He says, In support of All the President's Lawyers, I'll make another donation if Josh Barrow finally addresses the elephant in the room. Is Ken White a good lawyer? So, Ken, are you a good lawyer?
I get by.
Ken's being modest, I'm pretty sure that Ken is a good lawyer, at least today. Joshua, tweet us a screenshot of your second donation receipt, please. You promised. Thank you to everyone else who became a member this week. You can still show your support for the show and pick up an All the President's Lawyers swear jar. Those are available through next Tuesday. So this is the last time we're going to mention the swear jar on the show. Do it now before you forget. Go to kcrw.com/join. And again, thank you. When we come back, we will talk about Andrew McCabe. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. Ken, we have a listener question about former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe. McCabe got fired from the FBI as a result of an Inspector General report that said he had lacked candor when talking to investigators about the circumstances of a leak of information regarding an investigation into the Clinton Foundation. McCabe says his firing was actually retaliation by Donald Trump related to the Russia investigation, and Trump has made public statements, including on Twitter, that would tend to bolster that claim. We talked 3 weeks ago about McCabe's efforts to convince the Department of Justice that he should not be indicted over lying to federal investigators over the same matter for which he got fired. And now listener Shauna Lucy asks, what's going on with the case against Andrew McCabe? The grand jury declined to return an indictment. Now, Ken, Shauna put a period at the end of that statement about the grand jury declining to return an indictment. indictment, but my understanding is it's less clear than that, that we don't know if the grand jury declined to indict Andrew McCabe or not. So before we talk about McCabe specifically, can we talk about this process generally? So ordinarily, a prosecutor goes before a grand jury to ask that someone be indicted. If they do that, that's called a true bill. If they refuse, that's called no bill. It is very rare for a prosecutor to get no bill back from a grand jury, right?
Yes, it's very rare, with the exception of cases about police shooting people, in which it happens all the time. But it's notable enough that I only saw one in the 6 years I was a federal prosecutor. And generally, it represents something about the case resonating with the grand jurors in a way that they don't like. It's sometimes the equivalent of jury nullification before you even get to a trial jury. And sometimes it's a reasoned application of the standard, finding that this isn't probable cause.
So do we have good reason to think that it's likely that that happened in this instance? There was a letter sent from McCabe's lawyer to the Justice Department saying that they had heard rumors that this might have happened. What we do know is that there was a grand jury that had been dormant for months that got called back in on Thursday of last week, just after the Justice Department had indicated that they were not going to overrule the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C. that was going to seek the indictment of McCabe. And so I think people thought that, oh, the grand jury came back, it's going to return the indictment. But then we didn't hear anything. So is that a good reason to think that they called the grand jury back, they asked them to indict, and the grand jury said no?
It's a reasonable inference. It's not the only inference. They could have called them back to take some more testimony, to put in some more evidence until they eventually do seek the indictment. And it's possible that they have a few more, avenues they want to travel down based on the pushback they got from the McCabe camp, which could have educated them about what the weaknesses in the cases were. But I think it's more likely than not that the grand jury returned a no bill. I say that because the McCabe's attorneys are being very aggressive pushing the notion, and I think that unless they had pretty good reason to be certain, they wouldn't do so, because they'd wind up looking foolish if he just got indicted the next week. I think it would destroy their credibility to a certain extent. So I think they have some good intel, and there are lots of ways for a no bill to leak, precisely because it's so unusual. It would be the talk of the courthouse, and there are lots of avenues through which that information could leave.
Is it possible that he's already been indicted under seal? Because sometimes there's an indictment and it's not announced even though it exists.
That's true. You can have it under seal and only unsealed when they decide to do the arrest and the initial appearance. And we've seen that occasionally in the course of the Mueller investigation.
But so the usual reason you might do that would be, like things that are associated with people cooperating and that sort of thing. And so it interferes with an investigation for it to be publicly known that someone's been indicted. That presumably would not apply here. So what would be the reason for indicting McCabe under seal if he'd been indicted?
You might do it if you were going to do a bunch of search warrants when you arrested him and didn't want anyone to know about them. That's more or less what happened with Cohen. You might do it if you were arresting more than one person and you wanted to be ready to do the big takedown and nobody flee. You might do it if you thought he was going to flee, which seems extremely unlikely. Or if there was something else, some other part of the operation you were preparing to do that you weren't ready to do yet. But someone like McCabe, those don't seem like particularly good explanations for it.
So again, to your point, that's part of why you lean toward the idea that it's true that the grand jury was asked to indict and they declined.
That's right. And so once that happens, then a different set of guidelines from the Department of Justice manuals kick in. You can go back and try again with a grand jury, but it is discouraged. There are things that you are supposed to consider, and you have to take it to a higher level. So you have to get the approval of the U.S. attorney for the district. In order to do that, the idea being it's a pretty momentous step. You're trying to get a second bite of the apple to get somebody's liberty, and someone higher up with a cooler head should look at this.
But so those higher ups have already weighed in on this, right? I mean, we know about the meeting that McCabe's lawyers took at Maine Justice. I mean, I guess they'd have to weigh in again. They've even if they decided that, yes, they should seek the indictment, it would be a new decision to decide, yes, they should seek the indictment again, even though the grand jury refused the first time, say, you know, maybe that would give us pause in certain circumstances, but we've considered and know we really want to, we do want to seek this a second time?
Absolutely. And that would, you know, that would give him some arguments about potential selective or vindictive prosecution of the sorts that we've seen from various figures in all these investigations if they did something as very unusual as going back a second time.
And that's the elephant in the room here. It's clear that the president wants McCabe prosecuted. And so to your point, if they, you know, if they sought, if they finally got him indicted after having to go to more than one grand jury to get that done, that that would strongly suggest that some, there had been unusual influence down from the top, also, you know, corroborated by public statements the president has made.
Exactly. And if this hits the news, you know, there's no guarantee you get that indictment from the second grand jury. Maybe this one just had enough free thinkers to get the Nobel, or maybe the news about all this is prevalent enough there in D.C. where this is happening, where it's going to be hard to get it from any jury. You know, Josh, you pointed out that we saw recently after an acquittal that a jury said, you know, what are you doing this for when the Republic is burning? And that may be the sentiment behind these grand jurors.
Yeah, that was the acquittal of Greg Craig, the former Obama White House counsel who had gotten caught up in the Ukraine mess for which Paul Manafort was prosecuted, and there was an investigation of various other lobbyists. And so that that quote from that juror saying he was deeply offended personally that this particular case was brought against this particular man, unquote. So that was a trial in Washington, D.C. That was a juror on a Pettit jury. And so I want to go back to something we talked about a few weeks ago that you were skeptical of at the time, and I want to know if you've changed your view on this at all. Because my thesis was all of this stuff surrounding President Trump and the characters in this orbit, it's so high profile, it is especially so widely known in Washington, D.C., where a lot of people really pay a lot of attention to politics. And Washington, D.C. is an extremely heavily Democratic jurisdiction where approval of the president is very low. So isn't it likely that people in jury pools, both for Pettit juries and grand juries, are likely to enter these sorts of proceedings with a strong inclination toward the idea that whatever seems to be the president's side is the wrong side. And so that could lead to situations where a grand jury is unusually resistant to returning an indictment of someone who the president very publicly really wants prosecuted, or where a grand jury looks at a Democrat who's been caught up in an investigation that's mostly about the behavior of Republicans and looks at it and basically says, well, this, you know, this feels like an effort to look bipartisan, but really, why was this person prosecuted for this offense when there were so many other more serious things around it? It seems to me to give credence to the idea that really it is an unlevel playing field in Washington, D.C., or at least it's a jury pool that creates a significant disadvantage for the president's side of whatever any dispute is.
It's certainly possible, Josh, but I think the more sophisticated or obscure the case, the less that's going to be a factor. And, you know, the McCabe stuff is operating on a level, I'd say, a couple orders of magnitude below where a lot of jurors are going to be looking. But, you know, you never know. Maybe D.C. just is that hyper-political that even the people who can't get out of jury duty are focused on that.
There has been a new news cycle this week about Brett Kavanaugh. I don't want to get too deeply into this. This show is not about Brett Kavanaugh's legal problems. It's certainly not about Brett Kavanaugh's political problems. I want to talk about one specific aspect that fits within our mandate, which, you know, there's been this new reporting about, you know, more fragmentary claims about what people remember from parties 30 years ago or what people's friends say they don't remember from those parties or claims about people's character and, you know, their likely behaviors decades ago and those sorts of things. So the president says that over this sort of stuff, that the that Brett Kavanaugh ought to be suing someone for libel, and also saying the Department of Justice should be helping out Brett Kavanaugh. So first of all, is there anything that the Department of Justice could conceivably do here? I mean, there's no federal criminal libel statute. So even if Brett Kavanaugh had been defamed, I don't know what the DOJ would do. And in terms of a civil action, I don't know how the DOJ could possibly be a party to a civil action over potential defamation of Brett Kavanaugh. So what is there for the DOJ to do?
there really isn't anything. I suppose you could construct a scenario where some behavior was so absolutely extreme, it was seen as part of an attempt to intimidate a federal official. But we're nowhere near that. And the president was just... first of all, he said that Kavanaugh should sue for liable, not liable. And then he did say that he suggested that the Department of Justice should be Kavanaugh's leg breakers. And, you know, they're not. The Department of Justice does not exist to pursue the private interests of government officials. Any liable case would be most likely disastrous for everybody and miserable for everybody, because it would be very difficult to prove what you'd have to prove in a libel case, that someone was deliberately lying or acting with extreme recklessness. But this is kind of an outgrowth of something that Trump has done a number of times, really signaling that he sees parts of the government as fighting for him and his personal interests. And that this is just an extension of that, the idea that, hey, this is my guy. People are saying bad things about him. I should have the Justice Department do something about it.
Finally, I want to talk about some action from the Manhattan District Attorney, who is seeking Trump's financial records and tax returns from his accounting firm, both financial records relating to him personally and to the Trump Organization. This is related to the Manhattan DA's investigation into hush payments to Stormy Daniels. The U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York had investigated this matter, but the only person they ended up criminally charging over it was Michael Cohen. The Manhattan DA is looking to see, well, you know, were there other people who the feds didn't go after who we conceivably could? Anyway, so I can certainly see how these financial records could be relevant to that investigation. But my main question is, will we see them? And if we see even part of them, will we see them in their entirety? Because my understanding is, you know, even if they issue the subpoena, they obtain the records, they can only disclose them as part of a trial, right?
Right. Only on order of the judge. So I'm not as familiar with New York's grand jury secrecy law, but in general, they're not supposed to come out unless the judge says they can come out. So you might see them turned over in discovery if someone gets charged, and that's by a judge's order. You might see them used as exhibits at a trial. And of course, in 2019, you might see some of them leaked, because that happens. But what comes out and how it comes out is very much going to be governed by the defense strategy of anyone who gets charged. And we're way ahead of the game in speculating whether anyone will.
As I think about this case, there was Michael Cohen made these payments, and then he received reimbursement by filing essentially fictitious invoices to the Trump Organization, billing them for legal services, when in fact what they were paying was a reimbursement for the cost that he'd incurred personally to make these payments to these women. So that seems like something that could implicate financial records of the Trump Organization. It's not obvious to me, and maybe there's non-public information that I'm not aware of, but it seems much less likely to me that that would implicate the president's own personal financial records and tax returns, even if it did implicate the Trump Organization.
That seems to be true, although, you know, these people are not exactly doing everything by the book, and I don't think we've seen the end of the tax creativity that might have been connected to some of these operations. But I think you're most likely right. It's most likely to be the Trump Organization records and not his own personal records.
There is much more to talk about, but I think that's a good place for us to leave it. Ken White, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
If you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. You can also leave us a voicemail at 310-853-3514. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us. And Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.